You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Reggie Oliver is an actor. He's a playwright. He's also a writer, and his books include the collections of stories. These are from Tartarus Press, Mrs. Midnight and Other Stories, Flowers of the Sea, The Complete Symphonies of Adolf Hitler, The Dreams of Cardinal Vittorini, Masks of Satan, Holidays from Hell, The Ballet of Dr. Caligari, and Matter Mysteries, A Maze for the Minotaur, and his latest work is This Haunted Heaven. Thank you for joining me, Reggie.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you. Yes. Where are you, in fact? Whereabouts in the United States are you?
I'm on the West Coast, Santa Cruz. I'm about 8 miles south of Santa Cruz in a little town called Aptos. We have a perfect location for one of your stories. It's one of the many cement boats built during World War One, and it was moored here and became like a hot attraction. They had nightclubs on it, and it was very big in the 30s, 40s, and then eventually, you know, that kind of decayed, and so there was just like a little pier out to it, and you could fish it. When I came here 30 years ago, you could fish off the boat, and in the storm since, the pier has been, first the link between the boat and the pier was severed, then the entire pier disappeared, so now we just have this kind of like wreck out to sea.
Yes. So it's very, well, yes. I live near the coast and in Suffolk, and it's very much M.R. James country. In fact, I live about 7 miles from Aldborough, where he set one of his stories, and not far from Felixstowe, where he set another of his most famous story, A Whistle and I'll Come to You. It's a place full of history. It goes back to, Roman times, because not far from me is Icon, which is the sort of capital of the Iceni or Iceni, which is where Boudica or Boadicea came from and fought an unsuccessful rebellion against the Emperor Nero in 61 AD. So there's a lot of ancient history, and that's partly why I'm still fascinated by ancient history, and it seems to come into my books quite a bit.
I would say one of the things I really like about your short stories in this book, and we'll talk a little bit about that appellation or description, short story, is the sense of history you bring to it. I remember when I went to Britain, it was just kind of, you know, gobsmacking to walk around stuff that, you know, was, more than 1,000 years old. When I walk around, you know, where I live, if something's more than 100 years old, it's of note.
Yes.
So talk about a little more about how the sense of history informs your fiction.
Well, ever since I can remember, I've had a feeling for the past. I mean, as a child, I used to dress up in particularly an 18th century costume, and I don't quite know where it comes from. I think it's because I had a mother who, her mother was a Victorian, and she introduced me to books from a very young age, which were not modern books. You know, the first children's book I remember was Alice in Wonderland. And I immediately responded to that because it had a sense of strangeness about it. And the strangeness of the past with those wonderful John Tenniel illustrations, and also a sense of the macabre. And I have always had a taste for the macabre. It's a very strange thing. Some of my first memories in life are of nightmares. And the thing about it is that though I hated the nightmares and was terrified by them, I was also fascinated by them. And nearly all the nightmares came out of illustrations from old Victorian children's books of which we had. I remember one in particular, which I sort of converted into a story not so long ago, of a poem called The Spider and the Fly. "Will you come into my parlour?" said the spider to the fly. And the thing that got me, and indeed gave me nightmares, was not the poem so much, but the Victorian illustration of a horrible sort of half spider, half man. And it gave me such nightmares that my mother, who had the book, said, "Oh my goodness, yes, that same illustration gave me nightmares, and it gave my father nightmares." So my grandfather had nightmares from this same terrifying half spider, half man. You can imagine a modern horror film writer, Spider-Man, but a really unpleasant Spider-Man. He was sort of bloated, and well, you'll have to see the illustration to know what I mean. So I've always been connected to the past in a big way, because my mother was old fashioned. My grandfather, who I remember very well, he was born in 1874 and met Oscar Wilde at Oxford, you know. So I'm connected to the past in a way that very few people alive are.
You know, one of the things that I notice about this book is that a lot of the stories are set in or concern the world of plays and performance and acting and theater. And it made me think that this is a little more personal work for you, because you're an actor. And I think the circumstances you describe in these stories, which are just so wonderful, filled with detail and life and reality. It's not like some kind of exaggerated superhero thing. It's like, you know, kind of local theater, but perpetuated by, you know, professional actors who come and visit various places. Talk about the influence of acting and, for you, the act of writing.
Yes, well, again, it goes back. My grandfather was a Church of England clergyman, but he always really wanted to be an actor. And so both his children, my mother became an actress, and my uncle also became an actor. He was also an opera singer, a bass baritone, and he sung leading roles like Count Almaviva in The Marriage of Figaro. And my mother also was something of a writer. She kept diaries. And some of the details that I put into my stories about the theatre in the 1930s, before the Second World War, and indeed during the Second World War, come from her. And she used to tell me stories, and you know, odd little details used to excite me. Like, she used to say that when she did a lot of touring around, and actors go to bed late because they have their performance, but they're allowed to stay awake late. And she said one of her memories of touring is waking up in her digs and hearing the clogs of the workers in the mill towns of the north of England going to work, and thinking, those people who were walking to work will be coming to see me tonight, because it's, we think of the theatre nowadays as sort of elite thing that only middle class people go to, but in those days there was no television or anything like that, and the working classes loved to go to the theatre, and my mother played to them and liked them, and they liked this kind of melodramas and old-fashioned dramas that she was in, and all that has given me a kind of sense of the romance of the theatre. And also I think there's something else that Shakespeare said all the world's a stage. The stage is a kind of microcosm of life. And so when you get a theatre company, it's like the theatre company, it's like a small world. It's like a country, as it were, because you're performing and communicating out to your audience, but you are self-contained and usually very, very loyal to each other and working together, and that has a great romance for me.
You know, one of the things I really like about the works in this collection is that each story feels like a novel. It has all the details of a novel. You have a nice plot arc, a large cast of characters for short stories, where I'm somewhat used to, being raised on the tradition of a short story that's like maybe 4 pages long and has a big twist at the end,
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with that. You have The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. You have the almost any Poe story. So talk about what you create is something between, I think, a short story and a novella, or a novella between a novella and a novel. In a sense, you manage to get a novel's worth of feel and world in a longish short story, which I think is quite remarkable. How was this always your aim, or?
Very much so. I think, again, it has to do with being in the theatre. You want to create a little world, and a stage set is like a small world. I think it's very important. M.R. James said that the most important thing in a ghost story is atmosphere, and I would agree, but I think it's very important to find a new atmosphere, an atmosphere that's different, a different world. You can't go and use the old sort of the cliches, if you like, of horror, of clanking of chains, sinister monks, and things like that. It's quite fun to play with that, but to find a world of a new kind of world, which contains elements of horror, and introduce that. I think there's always, I suppose, what interests me is that in every world, in every milieu, there's always a sinister undercurrent, and it is in the interaction between the characters, and it is in what some people call the culture, the atmosphere, that is created by a group of people. And so for example, the first story in this collection, this Haunted Heaven, I've always been fascinated by sort of hippie communities, and in that story, what I find interesting and exciting to write about is the clash of two communities. There's the community of rather sober English archaeologists who are working on an archaeological site. And then there's a group, a rather hippie group, who are into some kind of mystical earth-based religion, and these clash and interact and coincide. So it's not just creating one particular world, but it's looking at the collision of different worlds. I'm also very struck by something that the great novelist Iris Murdoch, who was also a very fine philosopher, said, that she said, we differ not because we select different things out of the same world, but because we see different worlds. And I think that that's a very profound truth, that if you think of writers from Lovecraft to Stephen King, you know, they're seeing the world in their particular way. And the more idiosyncratic their view of the world, the more interesting it is. That's why they stick in the world. M.R. James is another, you know, his is a world of scholars and antiquaries, rather dry people who come up against another world which they don't expect and don't want. And it's, again, it's the collision of worlds which are created by partly by people, partly by external atmospheres that fascinates me.
You know, one of the things that I think is really fabulous about this book is that in these worlds you create, all of the stories are, you know, I think well-defined and described by the sobriquet, strange stories. But you would never, you know, resort to saying, okay, there's the vampires or there's this story. I mean, what's strange in your stories are the people and the relationships they wind up in. And then somebody manages to see something that we don't all see.
Mm. Yes, that's very true. And in fact, the simple fact is that I have never myself seen a ghost, but I have been present on at least two occasions when somebody else saw them. And in fact, one of those sights takes place in a theatre. And this was a friend of mine who was an actress and was acted with me long ago, and she used to see things, and she was, in other respects, you know, the most level-headed, kindest person. We're still very good friends, and I saw her recently, but she used to see things, and I say used to, which is interesting because about 2 years ago, she came to my house in Suffolk with her husband, and I and my partner had lunch with them, and we were talking about the things she used to see at the theatre where we both worked, and she said, "You know, I used to see all sorts of things and get all sorts of feelings like this, but at the age of about 50." All that stopped, you know, for some reason I didn't see these things anymore. And she said, you know, it's, in a way, it's rather a relief in some ways, but not in others. But it was rather like losing a sense of hearing or a faculty. So I think that people differ in that they see I have had strange experiences, but not in the sense of actually seeing a physical ghost. And I think we all have occasionally are susceptible to atmospheres. It is a sense. I mean, they call it the sixth sense, not unreasonably, I think. And that's what people who say, who sort of dismiss the whole ghost thing, don't really understand, is that different people have different views of the world, and they're not false or illusory views of the world. Sometimes they are, but sometimes people just see different things.
You know, one of the things I think that you do so well in these stories is fill them with details of descriptions of places, really create the places you set them well. And often they're, you know, this wonderful kind of slightly decrepit place that was a holiday place, maybe not anymore.
Yes.
But and also you fill your stories, and we were talking about this before, with all sorts of historical, some of the details are historical. And as I read this book in an electronic format, I was able to just highlight, you know, the places and names and go, wow, I never heard of that. So talk about incorporating real history and then mixing it up a little, just a scorn of the strange invented history in there, and creating this delightful kind of a story that's a mixture of the what feels real and is real and what is not real, but yet also feels real.
Yes, I think one of the things that I believe in very strongly is that imagination and memory are not separate things. They're interconnected. When people remember things, what they remember is actually their imaginative construction of something. And so you can, if you have this feeling and love for history, create a world out of a memory, not necessarily one that you have. It's a very strange illusion. There's an interesting sort of example from my own life when I used to, I still do occasionally keep diaries, and I have recently completed a novel which is actually about my theatrical experiences. It's a sort of haunted, mysterious novel. But I looked back into my diaries, and I received a great shock, which is that one of my clearest memories of this particular season, which is inspired my novel, was of the leading actor, who was happened to be at the time an alcoholic. He has reformed since then. we all lived in the same sort of block of flats, and I remember seeing him dead drunk, conducting in his underpants, conducting to a record of Toscanini playing the William Tell overture. And it's a vivid, vivid memory. And I looked it up in my diary, this incident, thinking that I would describe having seen him. And I discovered that I hadn't seen him do this. I knew what colour underpants he wore because he shared a dressing room with me. I had actually been told that he spent most of the night conducting the William Tell overture in his underpants in his room. So my imagination had created a memory. It was, if you like, a true memory, because that's what he actually did, but I never actually saw it. And I think this is how the imagination works. It is stimulated not simply by experience, but by what you hear of experiences and of other people. And so you can get a very strong historical acquire quite strong memories which are not in fact yours. And I believe that it's very important for a writer to, as it were, run a film inside his head, imagine what these things look like. And so it's a connection with the past through memory and imagination, but not necessarily your own memories, or rather they are memories, but what you have been told.
You know, that's really an interesting insight, because for me, the best books and the best stories, and these stories in this book certainly count among those, when you read them and then they're in your past and you think back on them, that if they're really good, the really good books will linger in your memories right alongside the vacation you took or the place you went, and there won't be much of a difference between them. And you can pull from those memories of reading a great book, and you know, as in the title story, you know, this haunted heaven, you can just see the places in that story and go there, especially the hippie haven when he first approaches it. I mean, it's just really a place where I feel that I've been. And I think that's one of the important parts of fiction, is to mingle with your memory so that your memory becomes a confabulation of the two. Now, one of the things I love about the stories in this book, and I think all the stories you write, there are other description strange stories. And it always makes me think, when I read these, it's like reading stories by the late, great Rod Serling, or seeing his work in the Twilight Zone. And for me, those stories occupied the same place for 20th century America, and yours also for 20th and 21st century America, that the Greek myths lived in the Greek culture, in that you use the lives of ordinary people and mingle them with the strange in a way that was compelling, memorable, but also had, you know, usually like a very subtle but firm moral. And I'm thinking of the stories in this book, Limbed Souls, which is just beautifully written. It's from the point of a young boy who's being tasked with helping hunt pheasants. And boy, I've never hunted pheasants. I would certainly never do so after reading this story. So talk about using your stories to tell like gentle morality tales with that twist of the weird that makes the morality much more, you know, understandable, comprehensible.
Yes, I think the sort of moral element just kind of comes out. If you force a moral onto something, it becomes artificial. And but it's fascinating you should mention that story, Limed Souls or Limed Souls, because that goes back to a time when I shared a cottage in the country with my brother long time ago. It was on an estate, and one of the things we used to do was to go beating. And I think
explain what beating is.
Yes. Yes. Well, the point is that you have the people who are shooting, who are the sort of the rich people who sometimes pay to stand with their guns and shoot, and then there are people who are sometimes paid or sometimes just given a hot meal for it, to drive the pheasants through the woods onto the line of waiting people who are waiting to gun them down. So you go through a wood because the pheasants naturally live in a wood, and they are actually raised by gamekeepers in the wood, and there they are in the wood, and normally they wouldn't fly about. They just walk around on the ground and eating their corn. But there's a line of people shouting and waving sticks, they will fly up, and they will fly away from the advancing line of beaters, and they will fly over away from the wood, over the line of guns. And this always struck me, even though I did go beating, mainly so that I could get a good free meal at the end of it, as strange. And also, there was, what was made it uneasy was this strange atmosphere of old time class distinction and feudalism, because the people who were beating, who obviously didn't pay to do it, but were sometimes paid, belonged to the sort of working classes, blue collar workers, as you would say, or agricultural workers, and the people who were with the guns were the aristocrats, the upper classes, the landowners, the bosses, as it were. And there was always this strange, uneasy relationship between them. Sometimes it was, genial and friendly, but there was always a distance between the two. And that's what fascinated me, the clash of two worlds. And yes, it has a moral dimension, this separation between two groups of people, but it comes out naturally in the situation. And it was the sort of strangeness, if you like, of that situation which fascinated me.
One of the things that makes the stories in this book so appealing are the characters and the character arcs. Talk about creating the characters in this book, and I'm thinking of a story called From the Man Seat. Now, I just love that. I had never heard that term before, but I love it because I have sat in that very seat, and so I know exactly what it is.
Yes. Well, I mean, that comes from a direct experience. My beloved partner, Philippa, loves going into shops, particularly clothing shops. And I think I may possibly deserve the credit for inventing that phrase. I certainly had never seen it before, but I thought there must be a name for this seat where you can sit down in a clothes shop while your beloved partner goes around and tries things on in the changing room and so on. So yes, and because I had that's how stories come about. You have the experience of going into shops and sitting down in those seats, and you think about it. You think, yes, that what is that seat? It's a man's seat. It's a seat for somebody, and then you recognize that in that particular seat, as it were, you have a particular kind of experience, which is unlike other experiences. And that's the way you can develop it into a story, when you recognize, as it were, the uniqueness of a particular experience that maybe hasn't been described before.
There's a story in here called The Ninth Curtain, which I just really loved. And I think it's a wonderful example of it's a complete and wonderful reinvention of the sort of fairy tale story where, don't listen to what the elf says because it's lying to you and it's going to lead you astray.
Yes.
Or you know, listen to when you've been warned about something, take that warning seriously. So, but I love the setting for this because it's just this horrible, awful kind of bar/hotel. Oh my God, yes. It's just really unky. Talk about creating these, you know, taking some traditional ideas and in a sense transforming them utterly into your own just by the use of detail and creating the locale, because the world building in this book is so great. I feel like I visited that hotel, much to my regret.
Yes. I mean, it was sort of bringing together of two different worlds. One is the sort of reimagining the nine circles of hell of Dante, hence the nine curtains, and the visions that he has correspond roughly, very roughly, to the nine circles of hell in Dante's Inferno. And then putting it together with the kind of pubs and hotels that, again, as when I was touring as an actor, that you stayed in, and they were pretty seedy, and there was, you know, the bar often had a jukebox playing music too loud, so that if you had a bedroom above it, you've never got to sleep, and the food was a bit sort of was pre-cooked and rather horrible, and the beer wasn't very good, and I suppose there's a sort of fascination with, you know, people have written about sort of superb, exquisite hotels and idyllic places, but most of the places that one visits in life are not idyllic. There's always, you know, usually something wrong with it, especially if you have to stay somewhere on the cheap, but that very inadequacy, as it were, of the place that you're visiting is a stimulus, because after all, if you're staying in crummy places, the best thing to do is to, as it were, make fun of them or make them into a story. You know, you can be funny about you can't be funny about a perfect hotel. You can be funny and interesting about a hotel with a rather unpleasant manager who's a bit sinister, and you know, you hear strange things going on in the next room. You know, already one's imagination is working on the memories one has of these places. It's the things that fall short of one's expectations that paradoxically, ultimately, are more stimulating to the imagination than the things that are absolutely ideal and perfect. After all, if you go to a perfect hotel and have a lovely stay there, you know, that's very nice, but you don't really remember it very well, because it's. But you do remember if you know, you turn on the tap and it brown water suddenly comes out or something like that.
You know, one of the stories I thought was really wonderful and interesting was a story called Behind You, and there you. That's a perfect example for me of, you know, where as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, is this real? Mm-hmm. So then I look it up, and yes, it is real. Then you try to look up the other thing, maybe not quite so real, but boy, sounds like it should be. So to talk about, like, and this is a story that uses YouTube. And I think one of the things I like about the stories in this book is, though the perception and the character has a lot of history. They live in the recognizably modern world. And so here's a story that reaches back 100 years and takes place in a sense so long ago, but also exists right now in the modern world. And that's a really interesting perception, because there's always this idea that the future arrives and completely erases the past. And it doesn't completely erase the past. It just sits on top of it until the past, until the future wears out and the past breaks through again.
Yes. Yes, that's so true. I've always had this feeling that you know, the past is sort of just beneath the surface, and it sometimes erupts and comes back to you, and as it were, it's like the old thing of the murderer haunted by his crime. It suddenly emerged, the telltale heart, and so on. It suddenly comes back. That is one of the sort of strongest elements that in strange stories of a past action or something suddenly erupting again. And again, in this, and I've used the device quite often because it happens to me that you see something, it might be a television or read a book or a story, and suddenly a past event comes back to you and haunts you again. It's a strange thing. It's something like you know, a dog with a bone. You start to nag at a particular memory. You start to think, why do I remember this? Why does it resonate me? And it might be some very, very trivial incident in itself, but arouses something deep within you.
You know, you used the word haunting, and I thought that one of the things that's extremely well done here is to take the word haunting for what it really means to most of us. On one hand, when we say something's haunted or you know, there's a ghost there, we think specifically of, you know, the soul of a dead person in an afterlife breaking through into our own world. And that's a very easy thought to have. And we see it all the time and read about it in books. You see it in movies. However, I think humans are in fact, the reason that is so familiar is that humans are a haunted race. But we're not haunted by ghosts. We're haunted by the memories of our own mistakes, by the things we did wrong that we knew were wrong, the things that, that we did right that still went wrong. And what haunts us is not the souls of the dead, but the acts of the living when they return in memory. And I think throughout this book, you do that really well. And one of the ways you do it is by the way you end the story. I think novels usually end, you know, with something like the end of The Lord of the Rings, where there's, you know, a big battle and a great reckoning and a celebration or whatever. For in these stories, it's like we're hurtling on a track and they end just before often, you know, the worst happens and then you realize, no, the worst doesn't happen. What we normally think of the worst doesn't have to happen. All we have to do is be haunted by the memory of that thing.
That's very true. That's very true. And I think... guilt is something which torments all of us, and it is a lot of my stories are not about necessarily the resolution of guilt. Sometimes the resolution of it, but but the recognition of it, the identifying of it,
That's
of
what's
that,
terrifying.
yes, it is. And and we don't know quite why this thing haunts us, but unless we're psychopaths, we are tormented. And I think that recognizing it does bring some kind of conclusion, but it's not, or closure, as you might say, but it's not a complete closure. And that, I think, is what makes the great ghost story, from The Turn of the Screw to M.R. James, even further back to Sheridan Le Fanu, that something is understood, something is recognized, but there is always an element of the unknown which remains. And if you achieve a complete resolution, then the thing is spoilt, not because there shouldn't be a resolution, but because it's unreal. Because in real life is inconclusive. There is no, there are no full stops, as it were. There is always there's a maybe a general diminuendo, but there is no absolute conclusion, except possibly in death. But then the ghost story is one of the things that says, no, death is just a temporary conclusion, and something goes on, and something survives.
Usually something that is inflicts pain on the living like memories. In this book there's just a wonderful variety of stories and variety of characters, and it makes me think, about and your ability to capture different voices. And it makes me think that, as an actor, what you do is you take a you're given a script and you bring that to life. As a writer, what you do is you create a script and then leave it to the reader who reads it to bring it to life. And I'm wondering if you talk about, the import of, I think what I call, what I is called, and I don't know exactly what this phrase means, method acting. In a sense, it feels like maybe the best writing is method acting.
I think that's very true. I think that's a very profound remark. I've always found that there's a way of identifying with characters. The strongest way for me is through the voice. You will see other actors say, "Well, I do it through." Sometimes you can do it through a gesture, but the voice is one of the most important things, and this applies also to the rhythm of speech, which immediately relates to writing, because all writing has or should have a particular rhythm and a pace. And of course, it particularly applies to poetry. When quite often when I'm doing creating a character, yes, does one create a character? A creative character is rather like a Frankenstein's monster. It's bits and pieces of other people who of people whom you know, and bits and pieces of yourself, which you fit together to make into a convincing whole. And this is why a lot of writers, including myself, get rather frustrated when people say, "Oh yes, X was really Y." No, it wasn't. You probably took, well, first of all, you took your own view of that particular person. It's like a painter painting a portrait. That portrait is not exactly like a photograph of that person. It's the person's individual view of it. But also you take little bits and pieces. Often you take a character in a particular situation, and you don't necessarily make it like the person you know. From the man seat, I happen to know a very well-known and award-winning opera director called Jonathan Moore, who's actually I've turned into Fergus Moore in the thing. But I haven't made the character of Fergus Moore like Jonathan Moore, except in his situation. I've created a slightly different character, but in the situation of an opera di director who w w wanders around doing different shows in different theatres, often in different countries, and forms strong relationships with people, and then they necessarily drift apart, so that he is always looking for the permanent relationship. But because of the nature of his work, he doesn't achieve a kind of settled, stable relationship with the person. And so when one's talking about taking characters, one often takes the situation of a person that a person is in as a kind of indication of character, and then creates a character out of that, or often a way of speaking, or a way of talking, or a way of thinking, or a person with a particular obsession. I wrote a story a long time ago about a woman who was absolutely obsessed by a murder case, and I based that on quite a well-known writer called Elizabeth Jenkins, who was in fact obsessed by a murder case and a particular character in that murder case, so much so that she sort of fell in love with this person who'd been dead for several hundred years, a man called Dr. Gully, in a famous murder case called the Bravo murder case. And when I visited her, she had a photograph of this 19th century doctor on her mantelpiece, and she'd apparently tried to get in touch with him via a medium. And the fascination for me, I made a story about, again, about that situation, though the character was not like Elizabeth Jenkins, of somebody kind of falling in love with a dead person, in a story, in a murder story. And that's really what one creates the character to fit the situation, you often, or rather, the character comes out of a character in a particular situation, like the lady in love with a dead person involved in a murder case.
Your new novel, when is that coming out?
It's coming out in next year in October. It's by PS Publications.
Oh,
It's
yay.
the title of it is Wings of Night, because it's about a haunted theatre. It's about a theatre company. It's very. I don't want to go into too much detail because it would it's kind of give away the story, but there are hauntings in it, but there is also something deeper about the building itself, which makes it, and it Wings of Night. It comes from obliquely from a passage of the Bible, which I've always thought of, found very poetic, though I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea. Thou art there. And then I thought, taking the wings of the morning. Yes, you're there. But what if you take the wings of the night? Would you find the same person there? That's the sort of idea behind it.
The new collection of short stories by Reggie Oliver is This Haunted Heaven, Where We All Live. Thank you for joining me, Reggie. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.